right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. What happens if one day I come in and say, I'm your host, somebody else? Then what'll happen? I wonder if there'll be an uproar. Probably not. Anyway,
at the back end of the show, we'll hear from David Swanson on why flag burning matters. David Swanson is an author and activist, co-founder and director of World Without War, and author of War No More, The Case for Abolition. And right now,
I'm really pleased to be bringing this segment of the show to you. Our first guest is Dar Jamail. He's a Truth Out staff reporter. He's the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And his new book coming out is The End of ICE. And this is exactly what we're going to be talking with him about. Dar, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Glad to be talking to you again, man. So much has happened since we last spoke, and it's all bad. Well, let's jump into this, man, because you've done extensive and deep investigation into the state of the planet. I imagine that's some of what you were doing during the summer when you were traveling around and all this stuff. But you've done this in relation to the climate. And I really want to hear from you where you think we're at in terms of the climate.
Well, it's really a dire situation. It's really not where I think we are at, but more of just watching what's happening and staying up on a regular basis with what are the most recent scientific reports and keeping a finger on the pulse of what's happening around the planet. And I think some of the most astounding things that have happened most recently is the fact that, again, this year already is being tagged by the UN's World Meteorological Organization as the warmest in the 136 years of record keeping that we have, which beats the previous hottest year, which was last year. And this is just a continuation of a trend. 15 of the 16 hottest years ever recorded have happened just since the year 2000. This autumn in the U.S. has been the warmest ever in record keeping. And if we look at the signs of what are things to come, most disturbingly, we're in the midst of a trend of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere. In fact, by the end of this year, we'll have reached a record rate of between 3.2 and 3.5 parts per million of CO2 having been added to the atmosphere this year, which is a record which surpassed the previous record, which was, again, only last year. So just for perspective on that, we're now at an interim of there's enough CO2 in the atmosphere where there's actually more CO2 in the atmosphere now than there has been since the Pliocene period 15 million years ago, at which point the last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere on Earth, the temperature was several degrees C hotter than it is now, and the seas were 80 feet higher than they are right now. So if we look at that and look at what we've already done to the planet, what's happening, and then the fact that we now have a Trump incoming president, and look at the people that he's appointing as head of the EPA. It just came out just this morning who he's looking at appointing as the head of the Department of Interior. You know, all of them climate science deniers, all of them pro-fossil fuel. I mean, not only are we not going to change things for the better, but we're preparing to have the gas stomped on to just keep going further down this road that we've been going down to lead us to this place where we are, which is intensely dire, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into Trump in particular in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you some other stuff about the development of these things, just so people understand that this isn't, and you're making this point, but I think it's really important for people to understand that what you're talking about, you know, this is not sort of a singular event this year or a singular event over the last 10 years, that there's actually an overall trend. And one of the things I think it's important for people to understand that this is something that actually has been building and it's now becoming something that's, you know, it's this behemoth that is actually the trend in the world now. It's not like it's sort of a little side stream that's coming up and we have to pay attention to, but this seems to be what's determining a lot of what's going on in the world. And you show James Hansen's graph in one of the articles you did, and you cite that. And it was, you know, for people who think that this is a slow-moving deal, it was really pretty shocking to see how just the graph just shoots up and how it's an extraordinarily fast-moving and consuming event. So let's talk about that a little, man.
Well, it really is. And that's the worrisome part about where we are now, is this is not a linear situation. And I think that's one of the most important parts of this discussion that I think people need to understand, that what's happening to the climate, it's not like, okay, we're on this steady, linear, increasing graph of just a consistent trend upwards, whether we're talking about temperature, sea level rise, or parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere or any of the other myriad elements associated with climate disruption, but it's going nonlinear, which means, you know, Michael Mann, the famous climate scientist out of Penn State who came up with, he calls it the hockey stick graph, where it literally looks like a hockey stick, where it's just kind of going along increasing steadily and then basically goes straight up. And what's causing that is essentially self-reinforcing feedback loops, positive feedback loops, however you want to refer to them, but it's basically something like, you know, the most famous example of these I can give is what's happening to the Arctic sea ice. So when the Arctic sea ice was healthy and we had full coverage pre the Industrial Revolution and before we started changing the climate of the planet and causing more of it to melt than is normal, then it covered the Arctic Ocean. So it had an effect of solar radiation coming in would hit the white ice and be most of it reflected back up into space. And as you raise the temperature of the planet, that ice melts. It exposes more of the dark ocean, which then absorbs more and more of that solar radiation and the warmth that comes with it, which then melts the ice faster, which then causes it the Arctic Ocean to absorb more and more of that radiation. And so it goes. And so once these loops get put into motion, it's impossible to reverse that trend. And if we look across the entire spectrum from that example that I just cited to intensified flooding, which then brings more silt out into the oceans, which then causes them to warm even more, which causes them to bring even more energy into the oceans and the planet. And so it goes as another example. And so there's myriad examples. And as of right now, there's now over 60 self-reinforcing feedback loops that have been kicked in as a direct result of human-caused climate disruption, human-caused warming of the planet.
Now, what you're talking about would also include the thing like the Greenland ice sheet, right, melting, and then what's happening in the Antarctic.
Exactly. And another example would be, you mentioned Greenland. There's been such a dramatic increase of forest fires, wildfires around the planet, both in their scope, the area burned, the intensity of heat they're generating, and the frequency and duration of them. So they're happening sooner, they're lasting longer, and they're going later into the season. I mean, we just saw this around the southeastern U.S. of a giant swath of wildfires, record-breaking wildfires, well into late November, just unprecedented wildfires, unprecedented record-breaking wildfires. That's one example. Russia, Siberian Russia, has been seeing huge amount of wildfire, again, very late into the season. And so all that soot is going up into the Arctic in places like Greenland and covering these vast areas of ice, which darkens them, which then has the same effect what I described with the Arctic sea ice. Then that ice, instead of reflecting most of the sunlight, it's actually absorbing more of it, which then increases the speed of melting, which is why every year now we're seeing record amounts of melting occurring in Greenland, both on top of it, and then as that water is filtering down to the bottom of the ice sheet too. And the same thing's happening in Antarctica, where not so much with the wildfire effect that I just described, but because the oceans are warming so rapidly, the western Antarctic ice sheet is now melting very, very rapidly. And even large parts of eastern Antarctica, which up until relatively recently people thought not really being touched, this was the one last big stable ice zone of the planet, even that now is starting to show significant impacts of increasing melting trends. And so very, very worrisome. I mean, and we're looking at sea level rise is starting to increase. And once again, whether we're talking about atmospheric temperature trends or sea level rise trends or any of the other markers, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they come out with their assessment every 7 years, and consistently their worst case predictions are not keeping up with reality. Their reality is far outpacing their worst case predictions. So, you know, they talk about a worst case prediction of between 4 and 5 degrees C increase around the planet by 2100, and yet there's a report that came out recently that I'm going to include in another climate dispatch that we'll be publishing this coming week that warns that we could be looking at between 6 and 8 degrees C by 2100. And there's other reports that even warn of far higher temperatures than that.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. I'm talking with Dar Jamail, author and journalist, and we're talking about the latest news, the latest really bad news on climate change, Trump, and the future of the planet.
Now, one of the things that keep coming back to my own head is the importance of people understanding that no matter whether you, when you look at these individual events, they are individual events to a certain extent, but they're actually, they are these things that you could describe them as a problem or a singular event. But the reality is this is actually a highly developed and accelerating crisis that interpenetrates with each other in a way that actually sort of amps everything up much, much more severely than ever before, right?
Right. I mean, everything's naturally completely tied together. I mean, it's one planet, it's one atmosphere, it's one giant oceanic system. Everything is intimately tied in with itself and with all of these other components. And so if you cause a great destabilization of one aspect of that, you're going to inevitably have a very profound impact on the others. So, for example, if we inject as much CO2 in the atmosphere as we have, as well as increasing the warmth of that, then the oceans are actually absorbing the brunt of the heat and a huge amount of the CO2 that we've injected into the atmosphere. And so that's causing acidification. At least the influx of the CO2, the absorption of the CO2 in the oceans is causing increasing acidification, which is wiping out coral reefs. And so we have leading coral reef experts around the planet warning that by 2050, so 2050, that's not that far off. We're talking less than 34 years from now at this point. There will be basically no major coral reefs left anywhere on the planet. And then think about what that does to fisheries, considering that more than a billion people on the planet as we speak, their sole protein source comes from fish harvested from coral reef areas. So how do those people eat? And then if we talk about sea level rise, even President Obama has spoken directly to this, that one of his primary concerns, and of course the Pentagon has addressed this in some of their security briefings as well, that what happens when the immigration situation worsens due to sea level rise, considering that the vast majority of the world's population lives relatively close or on a coastline, what happens when it's 10, 20 years from now and significant areas of coast start to become uninhabitable, which right now places like Miami Beach, for example, and Miami, where parts of the city, parts of their streets that are already during king tides becoming completely submerged. And a lot of the experts, even within these cities in the U.S., are saying, look, I wouldn't wait to sell my house here if I were you. And so what? Where do those people go? We're talking about millions of people that are going to be have to be relocated. And so, again, just that explanation that I just gave you, I mean, that's all directly tied from CO2 in the atmosphere. That's all directly tied as stemming from the CO2 in the atmosphere and the warming that comes with it, acidification, sea level rise, et cetera. So you can see how everything is, of course, completely linked to one another. And then, you know, you talk about warming the oceans. You know, we were just talking about that impact on Arctic sea ice as well is down in Antarctica. So you can see how everything literally does feed on all these other imbalances throughout the rest of the system.
Mm-hmm. And then into the middle of all this comes Trump, who says that it's a hoax, needs to be investigated, and has his own special programs for the environment. Let's talk about your opinion of that.
Well, it's really a stunning situation where he is literally the only Western leader on, or will be, I'm sorry, President-elect Trump, once he comes into power, will be the only Western leader that denies the reality of human-caused climate disruption. And I think, you know, to preface this part of the conversation, I've seen a lot of people almost saying, well, let's wait and see. He still seems he's softening a bit, or maybe he's somewhat open on the idea of climate disruption, and he's open to getting in more information because he met with Al Gore recently. He's met with Leonardo DiCaprio. DiCaprio apparently gave a copy of his recent movie, Before the Flood, which is all about climate disruption, gave a copy to either his daughter or his wife. I can't remember which one. So I've been seeing kind of this worrisome trend that people are like, well, maybe he's open, maybe he's going to do this. And I think it's a situation where we very much need to keep our eye on the ball, because this is somebody who, look at who he's appointing. I mean, he's appointing as the head of EPA, and then it just came out this morning who he's looking at appointing as the head of the Department of Interior. These are all literally fossil fuel funded individuals. I mean, just look at Pruitt, the Oklahoma's attorney general that he appointed as head of the EPA. The guy is a climate change slash climate science denier. He is funded by the Koch brothers, Exxon, and one of the largest coal companies on earth. Do the math. Does anyone really honestly believe that Trump, and when you look at who he's bringing in, head of the EPA, head of the Department of Interior, head of the Department of Energy, and all of these other people he's bringing into his cabal, are any of them the type of people that are going to look seriously at this crisis that we are in on a planetary scale and shift over to renewables and impose dramatic carbon taxes and do everything we need to do immediately to get off of fossil fuels and start transitioning so that we are prepared to try to live in this new world that we've created for ourselves? And, you know, it's try not to laugh while I'm saying this. I mean, of course, the answer is no. Not only is he not going to address this crisis, but he's bringing in people that are literally just going to be stomping on the gas of, you know, the fossil fuel industry. I think we need to brace ourselves for fights across the board to try to slow down, try to ideally stop, but at the very least try to slow down the immense damage that's going to be happening on a very, very wide scale and very rapidly. I think what people need to prepare for is just accept the fact that come January 20, that day that this man is sworn in and his cabinet takes power, expect within the first 24 hours a shock and awe of legislation across the board, and not just with climate disruption, but everything. But since we're talking about climate disruption, be ready for the fight to be brought to us immediately by these people, because they will be going after everything that's left. So the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and all these other places, including, I would argue, all of our national parks at this point are going to be on the chopping block for the fossil fuel industry. They're going to be trying to get in there every way that they can. So that is what we're confronting. And then, you know, the final thought on that is it couldn't obviously come at a possibly worse time, where right now we need to be thinking like Norway, where as a country, they're talking about trying to become a country that's 100% off all fossil fuels by the year 2030. And the whole world needs to be thinking like this and instead look at the direction we're about to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that a lot of pundits are saying these days is that the amount of damage that Trump could do, you know, well, yeah, okay, he can do some damage. But even the people who are, again, the people who are, like you're saying, like, you know, Gore and DiCaprio and all these people who are trying to look, is there a way we can sort of grease him up and like letting, you know, maybe we can tone him down a little bit. But all these things, they're saying that the damage that Trump could do is limited, that there's checks and balances and all these different things that can come into play that would hold him in check. What do you think of that?
I think people need to really understand the reality of this individual, Donald Trump. This is someone who has never spoken honestly. He's never shown any signs of integrity. He has zero experience in governing. He is a con man and a bad one at that. I think Senator Rubio, during one of the Republican primary debates, I think really described Trump perfectly when he said, you know, they were really getting into it as the heat of battle during the debate. And Rubio said, look, Trump, if you hadn't inherited all the money you did from your father, you would basically be selling fake Rolexes on a street corner in Manhattan. And I think that that's a very vivid description of this individual. And instead, he's a media-generated phenomena because of Celebrity Apprentice, a show which he just announced that he's going to maintain his executive producer position of while he's president. I mean, this is a demagogue. He's extremely dangerous. And I think, why would you think that this individual is going to respect the law or how things are done in government, let alone the Constitution of the United States? You know, we saw George Bush in several ways infringing upon the Constitution of the United States, calling it's just a piece of paper, et cetera. And now we're in a position with Trump and the people that he's bringing into his cabinet where I never, you know, having reported from Iraq going into Fallujah as a result of George Bush's policy and the things I saw and had to report on there, I never in a million years would have thought that the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice cabal would be perceived as moderate. But compared to what Trump is setting up and is going to be bringing in to run things in D.C., I'd have to say that Bush is appearing moderate at this point. I think we are moving into an extremely dangerous period, and I don't think it's really out of line to say this must have been about what it felt like to be in Germany around 1931.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. This is a fascist onslaught here. And one of the things I wanted to ask you in relation to this is you just brought up your experience in Iraq. And you wrote a piece recently that I think is really important for people to understand. This is sort of stepping back a little bit from the climate and what's going on there. But you wrote a piece on James Mattis. And I want people to understand sort of this overall picture of the Trump regime and some of the people that he's bringing in. And you in particular had something, some exposure of Mattis that was just incredible as a war criminal. And I think in relation to Fallujah, and I think it would be really good for people to hear some of that assessment.
Right. So retired Marine General James Mattis, this is a guy who was head of CENTCOM, Central Command for U.S. military, which is based over in just on the outskirts of Doha, Qatar. He was head of that up until 2013. This is a guy who takes issue what he calls political Islam. He is essentially demonizing the entire religion of Islam. He's in line with this part of the Trump Kabul that basically is demonizing Islam in totality. So that's a very dangerous thing to do. And it has said many controversial things. He's earned himself the nickname of Mad Dog because he's essentially said during speaking of basically being involved in the conflict in Afghanistan, said, "It's fun to shoot some people. You know, it's a hell of a hoot." And that's a direct quote. And then a little bit later, just a couple of years after he said that, talking about how he was advising soldiers on how to behave in Iraq, and he was on tape saying this, during a speech he gave in 2003 when he told them, quote, "Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet." So that's him. And then a couple of things about him regarding on the ground of how that type of mentality plays out from Iraq. And in the April and November sieges of Fallujah in 2004, he was responsible for large contingents of Marines who participated in those sieges. I was in Fallujah in the April siege and then covered it from right on the outskirts of Fallujah in the November siege. And I saw things with my own eyes of literally Marine snipers shooting babies, shooting children, shooting women, a deliberate targeting of ambulances, shooting civilians en masse, using things like depleted uranium munitions, and then during the November siege using white phosphorus, which is a weapon that by UN conventions is a restricted weapon. Restricted meaning that it's not illegal to use, but it's restricted. You're not allowed to use it if there's an area where there could be civilians. And by the Pentagon's own admission, during the November siege, when they used it, there were upwards of 50,000 plus civilians still in Fallujah. So that amounts to a war crime, along with those under his command committing the various war crimes that I just described. And then a year later, in November 2005, everyone's probably has the sordid memory of the Haditha massacre, where U.S. Marines were struck by a roadside bomb and then went into a small part of Haditha nearby the attack and basically just took their frustrations out on people. They shot at close range multiple times, 24 different unarmed, innocent civilians, everything from kids to women to an old man in a wheelchair, all of them completely unarmed. None of them had anything to do with the attack. It was extremely well documented in the international press. And then, of course, when it came time for something like justice to be brought for those involved, Mattis had convening authority over all of the 8 Marines who were charged with the crimes in Haditha and went on to dismiss all of those charges that had been leveled against the Marines involved in that massacre. And only one of them still faces any kind of possible prosecution, but we can only guess where that's going to end up. So this is the guy who is now the nominee, and it's already being talked about that it's not going to be resisted, his nomination process. So this is the guy who's going to be Secretary of Defense.
Mm. Yep. There you go. All right, Dar, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me again, Michael.
Always yeah. Talk with you. And listen, man, when your book comes out, we're definitely going to have you on maybe for the entire show. We'll have you on for the show and we'll talk about it, man, because I think we want to keep pursuing this as much as, and as your articles come out, I'll pull it together with that too. But I really want to pursue this with you in an ongoing way, all right?
That'd be great, Michael. Look forward to it.
All right, Dar. Thanks a lot, man. Take care.
Take care.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dar Jamal, a writer for Truth Out. He's the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. He is also a prolific writer on what's happening with the environment, and his upcoming book is The End of ICE, and we'll have him on the show again when that book comes out. All right, I want to thank each of you for listening to the show today, and I want you to listen to something, because as Dar was talking about, when he's talking about all the stuff that's happening with the environment, when he's talking about that basically there's a whole situation that's coming up with the nomination of Mattis as the Secretary of Defense and all of the other things that are falling into place, all of the ways that Trump is actually pulling together what can only be honestly described as a fascist regime. If it looks like a fascist, if it smells like a fascist, if it talks like a fascist, if it acts like a fascist, it's a damn fascist, okay? Let's just be clear about this. It's extremely important that people don't think that they can go around and just sort of like, oh, well, we'll try and find a way to, we'll make the Democrats have more influence, or we'll do this. No, you're dealing with a modern day Hitler, okay? Let's be clear about this. This is extremely important. And along that line of thinking, I want people to hear this statement that's been put out recently. We read it when Andy Z was on my show, but I want you to hear a reading of it from Miles Soleil, who's part of the band Outer National. So check this out.
In the name of humanity. In the name of humanity. In the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. Rise up. Get into the streets. Unite with people everywhere to build up resistance in every way you can. Don't stop. Don't conciliate. Don't accommodate. Don't collaborate. Donald Trump has now won the presidency. Under the slogan, Make America Great Again, he has viciously attacked Mexicans and Muslims, threatened to deport millions, and boasted that he would build walls and close borders. He incites people to fear and hate those who are different, or who come from other countries or nationalities, or practice different religions. He crudely demeans and degrades women, and openly boasts of molesting them. He's a champion of white supremacy, who has insulted and threatened black people, and whipped up racist lynch mob mentality. Trump has mocked the disabled. He's an aggressive and unapologetic militarist who threatens to use nuclear weapons and has his fingers on the nuclear codes. He openly advocates war crimes and crimes against humanity, including torture and killing the families of those accused of terrorism. He plans to pack the Supreme Court with justices who will gut and reverse the right to abortion, gay rights, and other important legal rights. He calls climate change a hoax, and his policies will wreak further devastation of the environment. He has attacked and threatened the press and stirred up his supporters to do the same. Trump has utter contempt for facts and the truth, and consistently lies to advance his agenda. As for the rule of law, Trump went so far as to threaten his opponent, Hillary Clinton, not only with jail, but even assassination. Donald Trump is an outright fascist. 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 And he is now the president-elect. Fascism is a very serious thing. Fascism foments and relies on xenophobic nationalism, racism, and the aggressive reinstitution of traditional values. Fascism. Fascism. Fascism feeds on and encourages the threat and use of violence to build a movement and come to power. Fascism, once in power, essentially eliminates traditional democratic rights. Fascism, fascism, fascism attacks, jails, and executes its opponents and launches violent mob attacks on quote-unquote minorities. In Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, under Hitler, fascism did all of those things. They imprisoned millions in concentration camps and exterminated millions of Jews, Roma people, gypsies, and other quote-unquote undesirables. And Hitler did almost all of those things through the established institutions and the quote-unquote rule of law. This is where this goes. And yes, Hitler himself could talk graciously when he thought it would serve his interests and lull his opponents. Trump did not even win the popular vote, even though he did win the Electoral College, which decides elections in the United States. Hitler himself came to power through democratic procedures, including the process of elections. Should people have accepted Hitler? Unfortunately, they did, at a horrific cost to humanity. Today, with nuclear weapons, that cost could be far higher. In the name of humanity, in the name of humanity, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. The fact that Trump won as many votes as he did must be understood. The fact that he got even more than 10% of the vote is disgraceful and reflects some very ugly things about America. So why did this happen? The world today is turbulent, full of changes. Those who supported Trump's fascist program were overwhelmingly sections of white people, especially but not only white men, who yearned for the days of open white supremacy and global American domination and the blatant subjugation of women. A significant minority of white people did oppose him, but we have to confront how deep the racism, the national chauvinism, and the hatred of women is woven into this society. And not give in to this, but fiercely and vigorously oppose it. But even more than this, Trump was backed by powerful forces in this society. Beyond those who directly supported him, the media, the Democratic Party, and others treated him as a legitimate candidate, refused to call him out as the fascist he is, and now call on everyone to accept his ascension to power. All the major forces in this society bear the responsibility. It is they who have, over decades, either built up this fascist force or enabled it. You cannot try to wait things out with fascists. Those who lived through Hitler's Germany and sat on the sidelines, looking on as Hitler rounded up one group after another, became shameful collaborators with monstrous crimes against humanity. Trump and his regime must be resisted and defied, beginning now, beginning now, beginning now, in many different ways and in every corner of society. Reconciliation and collaboration would be nothing less than criminal and deadly. Literally. People, come together, resist, let the whole world know that we will not allow this to stand.
That was Miles Soleil from the revolutionary band Outer National, reading a statement from RevCom.us, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And I want to recommend, in fact, I want to urge you to check out a new website. It's called RefuseFascism.org. Once again, that's RefuseFascism.org. And there's a call there for a month of resistance beginning December 19th. And you're going to find a plan and a proposal to stop fascism now, right there. So that's refusefascism.org. You can also find links on my Facebook page, and we'll have more to say about this important topic on next week's show. We're going to take a musical break and be right back with David Swanson on Why Flag Burning Matters.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, rock me in the cradle, child, carry me to the grave.
Bibles, guns, and flags.
Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved.
Guns and flags.
Bye, Bibles, guns, and flags.
All right. right. Bibles, Guns, and Flags. All right. That's a tremendous song, and we're not going to – I'd love to play it all the way through, but David is sitting there, and he's chomping at the bit waiting to get into this. David, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. Welcome to the show, man. It's been a while since I've talked to you.
I think so. Yeah, yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Let's get into this. You wrote something that actually catches the eye of anybody who's – and I'm sure catches a lot of red eyes. Basically, people just like, what the hell is he saying? Why Flag Burning Matters. What moved you to write this piece?
Well, I guess a Donald Trump tweet is what made this a burning public issue for everybody in the past 24 hours or so. But, you know, of course, Hillary Clinton as well had signed on to legislation and pushed for legislation to put people in prison for burning flags that thankfully hasn't passed yet. You know, and the majority of the U.S. public for years in polls has wanted a ban on burning flags, although it's ridiculous and unconstitutional, and it's a violation of the First Amendment in terms of speech and in terms of religion, because it really is a religious object, the United States flag. It's something that has to be treated as a sacred object, cannot be desecrated. When a high school football player, you know, sits out the worship of the flag during the national anthem with the proper hand position and so forth, they're excommunicated from the church. You know, they're suspended from school. They're punished for not standing properly during flag worship ceremony. And of course, it's a question of free speech as well. If you look at a local flag, a state flag, an international flag, there's none of this nonsense. It's always the flag with the military associated with it, and it's the U.S. flag in a way that is unseen in the rest of the world. You know, the other 96% of humanity does not have this level of flag worship, of flag religion. And this is something that is generally used in the United States to promote war. You have this organization called the Advertising Council, which was created for World War II propaganda during World War II. It still exists for some reason, like everything else that was created for World War II, is putting ads on TV promoting patriotism and flags. You know, not promoting, you know, humanity, not promoting environmental protection or end to poverty or love or brotherhood or any policy agenda, just patriotism, just flag worship. Just free advertising on top of the military's own $700 million a year advertising budget. So it matters to me that we be allowed to abstain. We be allowed to not join that church.
Well, you know, it's very heavy, man, because a lot of the things you're saying, but also I happen to have had, he's a friend of mine, and I happen to have had him on the show a number of times, Joey Johnson, who actually was the notorious flag burner way back during the Republican convention in the 80s, and who was convicted for burning the flag and actually had to fight the case all the way to the Supreme Court with Bill Kunstler being his lawyer, and they won. They won the declaration that said that it is not illegal to burn the flag. And it was an extremely important step for people. And this is something, I mean, you know, it's interesting to me because when you're talking about what people around the world know, it is often the case that anywhere there's a massive uprising against the most severe repression and oppression, you're going to see people burning the American flag. And to me, that's something that's very, very important in terms of not just, you know, yes, the question of freedom of speech, that's all very important, but it's also, it's a question out there to put straightforwardly, look, this is not an accident. This symbol actually does stand for something pretty heinous to the people of the world.
Yeah, well, to many people, to people living under U.S. bombs, to people living under U.S. economic warfare, to people living near abusive and destructive U.S. military bases, which is a huge percentage of humanity. And so there are images on U.S. television of people in some foreign land burning a U.S. flag who would also like to bomb U.S. cities, or at least this is the message conveyed. Were I to burn a U.S. flag, which I've never actually taken any interest in doing, but were I to burn a U.S. flag or sit out the national anthem, which I always do, I don't mean by that that I want to bomb U.S. cities, much less that I want to bomb U.S. cities on behalf of some foreign nation. You know, what I mean is that I don't want to join in the worship of a national government or its military, that I think it's incredibly destructive, that I identify with the people of my town and my state and my region, but why must I have this religious identity with people at the level of a military and back that military as a matter of religious faith, when it ought to be the responsibility of the people of the United States to determine the policies of its government as a question of self-governance in a supposedly representative republic. And that ought to be able to include saying no to wars. And you can't say no to wars if you're told, not now, there's flags waving. You know, the two senators who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution for the war in Vietnam spoke to many of their colleagues in the Senate before the vote and found that they agreed, but they wouldn't agree publicly. And they said, when the flag is waving, you cannot speak against war. There's a when MSNBC threw my friend Jeff Cohen off the air and Phil Donahue off the air as the 2003 stage in the war on Iraq was started. There was an internal memo at MSNBC. When a flag is waving in wartime, you know, we can't have someone, you know, thinking out loud on television. It would be disgraceful. This is why I'm against restrictions on flag burning, not because I actually have a stack of flags I want to burn.
Well, if you ever change your mind, come see me, man, okay? I think it's actually really important what you're saying. And one of the things you start off your article with something that's really kind of intriguing. You say, the national religion of the United States of America is nationalism. Its God is its flag. Its prayer is the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's dig into that a little bit more.
Yeah, and its ceremony is human sacrifice, sacrifice of the sacred U.S. troops, who are, of course, sacred up until they need medical care or housing, and then screw them. But the attitude of the U.S. government is that by sending young American men and women off to kill and die for the flag, they are constituting a sacred nation that must be worshipped under the banner of that flag through the proper fascist ceremony and robotic recitation of pledges by kindergartners on up that creates thoughtless obedience. And now, of course, as I go into in this article on counterpunch.org, now you have the U.S. government killing U.S. citizens as well, directly with missiles from drones and otherwise through a policy of open assassination of just about anybody, just about anywhere, including U.S. citizens, supposedly only if they're outside U.S. borders. And so the sacrificing via the tool of a foreign army is short-circuited, and it goes straight to sacrificing U.S. citizens directly for the flag when they've been labeled enemies. And these are all the tools that are being handed to the guy who's coming into the presidency saying that he wants to imprison flag burners. He will have more powers than any other human being ever before on planet Earth, as did Obama, as did Bush, but now they're greater. Now you have wars at the president's discretion, no bother to go lying to Congress about weapons, just start the wars. Now you have go through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays and pick which ones to murder with drones. And it remains a pressing and open question whether people are going to object to that stuff now because it's going to be Trump doing it, or whether having sat on their hands for 8 years of Obama doing such things, they're now going to be in the habit of accepting them even when it's Trump doing it. And I can't answer that yet.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important, too, to talk a little bit about what you mentioned in the beginning of this when you said that actually with Hillary Clinton and her advocacy for really going after the jailing of flag burners. You know, I don't know how much people actually have really paid attention to that in relation to everything that was developing in the last few months. But that's an extremely important point.
Well, I know if they're Democrats, they have conscientiously avoided it entirely, as, you know, is the habit with people's news consumption these days. And if they are Republicans, they are often quite well aware of it. This is a problem with our, you know, with the whole ingestion of self-selected information and the whole fake news scandal and so forth, is that people are choosing what to know. And the fact is that Hillary Clinton publicly advocated for and officially signed on and co-sponsored and lobbied for legislation that would have put people in prison for burning a flag. That is not yet law, and as you say, there is a number of court rulings, not to mention the First Amendment, against it. But her position on that, just like Donald Trump's position on it, was, let's see which way the wind is blowing, that's what I'm for. And Donald Trump uses it in a unique way, in a way more reminiscent of Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler than Hillary Clinton has. But she took the same position because not because she has, it was with her principles. I don't think she has any principles, just because that was the way it looked like the wind was blowing. And we ought to have more of that in a representative republic, but we ought not to have it when it goes against particular standards and protections of minorities and protections against dangerous fascist tendencies. And this was something that even the founding fathers of this country, these racist, genocidal slave owners, knew. They got this right, and neither Hillary nor Donald can.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with David Swanson, and David is a radio show host. He's an author and activist, co-founder and director of World Without War, and we're talking about a recent piece he did called Why Flag Burning Matters. David, you know, there's something in, and I'm just looking at your piece again, and it's sort of, there's a point in here, a lot of these things that you talk about, like this being a religion, and you actually paint this as having you know, all the paraphernalia of a religion, a wacky, backward, reactionary religion, although I don't have any religion myself, but basically the point of you make a point of that there's all these myths that have to get built up around this. And it's really an important point, because this is something when you're talking about Trump coming in and, you know, Trump being president, and it's something that's been part of what's being plowed up for decades now, but especially over the last 8 years. And since this sort of the U.S. really being challenged in the world and stepping out to try and fight and get all of its, protect what it considers its ownings and expand itself, and just horrendous, the fascistic stuff that they've been doing, the genocidal stuff they've been doing in the Middle East is just completely beyond any scope of, oh, well, we could understand that or something. This is genocidal horror. And I wanted to talk about this because you talk about these things of, there's actually certain beliefs that people have here. And one of them that really struck me, because it's, you call it a Dream Act that would give citizenship to immigrants who kill or die for flag, and that embodies the deepest dreams of flag worship. Let's talk about that statement.
Yeah, well, I don't just call it that. That's what it's called. The legislation in Congress for years has been called the Dream Act, that would do many good things for immigrants to the United States. But part of trying to pass an act to allow people to become citizens of the United States has, in every version proposed across the political spectrum, included the idea that, well, if you're willing to go off and kill and die for U.S. government's wars, for, as Donald Trump puts it, stealing their oil and killing their families, well, then you can become a citizen. And so it becomes a piece of legislation that ties citizenship to participation in mass murder and makes that the price for immigrants, in particular immigrants who can't afford college, to become citizens of the United States. And these are immigrants who've come to the United States thinking well of it, thinking enough of it to want to come and live here, and who perhaps have not studied U.S. foreign policy, perhaps have not been fully informed of what they're signing up for, but sign up for it as a path toward citizenship, just as so many U.S. citizens sign up for it as a path toward college, where if we had free college, as we ought to, as a basic human right of education, and it's easily affordable for the U.S. government, if we had free college, then you wouldn't have all those people signing up. But you have created a system that views mass murder and eternal warfare and bombing of foreign nations, bombing of individuals in foreign nations, as absolutely routine to go on. And its participants, veterans, must be honored, even if hypocritically, and we must see about giving some little benefits to veterans to avoid giving them to everybody, which would build a stronger society. And you have the high priest in the form of the commander-in-chief, which once you've given nuclear buttons to the high priest of the U.S. national religion, well, I mean, this is beyond the powers that most religions have ever even pretended for their high priests, and this is real, you know, and this guy has them and has led over the decades since he got them to Congress abandoning all of its pretenses of power up against the president, and the president becoming really a figure of a religious and secular commander of a flag-worshipping, war-engaging society.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something that you say in the piece, too. You say, if our courts killed without trials, there would be, by definition, a risk of killing the innocent. Okay, very important point. Then you say, the same should be understood when a president and his flying robots or missiles or night raids kill without trial. Let's talk about that, because that's something I think people don't put together.
Yeah, well, we know now that the U.S. drone policy targets primarily people who have not been so much as identified at all. Nobody knows their name. They're right there. They're targeted because of where they are, what they look like, what they might be engaged in. And even that small fraction of those who are targeted because somebody knows something about them have not been put on trial, have not been indicted, have not, their extradition has not been sought. The idea that you're only targeting people who could not be captured, blatantly false in many, many specific cases we know of where people could have very easily been arrested and were not, and possibly in every single case. The idea that these are people who are an imminent threat to the United States is absolutely absurd in every single case that we know of. The notion that drone murders are avoiding killing the innocent or killing civilians is absolutely ridiculous. The one conversation in real time of drone pilots discussing what they're doing before they murdered a bunch of innocent people involved them calculating the risks of how many innocent people they would kill, which obviously wouldn't exist. That conversation wouldn't exist if the president's stated policy of near certainty of killing any civilians was actual policy. The vast majority of the people killed with missiles from U.S. drones, not to mention other U.S. warfare, are innocent and civilian by everybody's definition. And we still have the death penalty in U.S. courts and in Texas and Georgia and Virginia. And you have numerous documented cases of killing the innocent, but not nearly in the numbers or the proportion of U.S. drone killings or U.S. police killings, for that matter. And the same mentality carries over between those two fields of militarism as policing and policing as militarism back home.
You know, along the lines of what you're saying, and I can't let this go because it's really it's important. John Brennan, and the whole thing that happened around with Obama and him, and the pointing out of what were the targets to be hit by the drones this week, and who was deserving of death. And there's a point here where Obama has gone on and declared, and it's in relation to that whole sort of ethos that's going on, where Obama has declared that, and this is you want to talk about Orwellian. The president has declared that any unidentified dead male of fighting age was, by definition, a militant. After all, he was killed. Now, those are your words, but this is a pretty powerful thing for people to think about.
Right. I mean, this is how they distinguish, they being the U.S. military and the White House, distinguish militants from civilians, and in this conversation I was referring to, the only one we have, and we only have the transcript, not the audio or video, of this drone kill, they were talking as if any male, any age above 10 or above 9 would constitute a militant. And so, of course, once you've killed somebody and presumed them to be male, which, you know, is a presumption. You're looking at little green fuzzy blobs that look on something that looks like a 1980s computer game. You know, they've presumed this person to be a male, and they've presumed on the basis of height, almost exclusively on the basis of the person's height, they've presumed them to be at least double digits, at least 10 years old. Well, then they are militant. You know, and there's no need for any concern or investigation or question of legality or morality or practicality or anything else. They're a militant. You know, another thing that the president and the high priest of killing has said with pride is, I'm very good at killing people. And that's something that some Republicans know and virtually no Democrats know because of what we choose to allow ourselves to know. But that's what he has said.
Mm-hmm. Now we have time for one more question. It's going to have to be, you know, within 2 minutes or so, 2.5 minutes. And I wanted to ask you this, and it's kind of a combination of things. You know, you talk about we have a responsibility to look at all this, to actually be, look at all this with a clear vision, with clear eyes, that we have a responsibility to do that. We also have to think about this. There's no excuse for allowing the government to do what it does. And that actually people should stop thinking that they're exercising some sort of like free will here, that in a certain sense, or they're just not free will. They are in fact exercising free will if they choose to do this or don't choose to do it. But actually the idea that actual robots can perform the Pledge of Allegiance as well as any human. And this is extremely important in the world today because people do have a responsibility. And I think you make this point. We have a responsibility now to deal with this very quickly.
I don't think anyone should be allowing their children to be subjected to a fascist-era ceremony of robotic repetition and flag worship and hand position in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. You know, Europeans stare at this in disbelief and horror and consider it fascistic, and rightly so. I'm hopeful that Donald Trump's election, or whatever you want to call it, but his likely installation in the White House, for a certain segment of the U.S. population anyway, that has been lacking in proper resistance during the past 8 years, is going to find itself more open to protesting the national anthem and protesting militarism and protesting presidential wars and presidential murders. And I hope that to the extent that Donald Trump ends any practices of regime change, as he continues to claim, and thaws any cold wars with powers like Russia, we will thank and applaud and encourage. But to the extent that he continues any of these crimes or expands on them, we will resist in a way that we haven't seen in recent years, and that we won't hold off because a flag is waving or music is playing or the military has bought a bunch of slick advertisements to show on our televisions.
All right, David Swanson, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, look forward to talking to you again. All right,
okay.
Take care. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to remind people that actually, you know, there is a current case of flag burning going on right now in Ohio, related to the burning of the flag in during the Republican National Convention. And there's a number of people, including Joey Johnson, who are facing serious charges there. And people should pay attention to that and go to revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us and Revolution Newspaper to keep up on this. All right. And that's extremely important that people stand with those people as they basically refused to be fascistic robots. And they took a stand with the people of the world by burning that flag. All right. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank our two guests, Dar Jamil and David Swanson. And again, check out the website, refusefascism.org, and plan to stop fascism now. No. Plan to stop. Yeah, plan. Okay, well, maybe I'll plan. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just go to the movies instead, huh? And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank our two guests, Dar Jamil and David Swanson. And again, check out the website, refusefascism.org, and the plan to stop fascism now. That's a real necessity, folks. Stop fascism now. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with 99 Revolutions from Green Day. Talk to you again next week.